With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, friends, and welcome to a new episode of Your Own Personal Beatles. I am, as ever, Jack Pelling.
And I'm Robin Allender.
How are you doing, mate?
Yeah, really good. We've got a great episode lined up for you.
Yeah, it's a very hot day, and we've got an episode we recorded on a very cold day, because I think we did this as far back as maybe even February.
Yeah, when you listen to this, there's a lot of talk of the Adam Buxton, Paul McCartney interview and McCartney 3, so it was definitely, you know, fairly soon after that, wasn't it, early in the year?
Yeah, so this is Jeff Lloyd in the depths of the second lockdown, yeah. Or was it the third lockdown?
I don't know, whichever
one. Which one you count.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a really, really fantastic chat. Jeff Lloyd is a brilliant broadcaster and writer, and you might know him from his work on the radio, and he does a few brilliant podcasts, one this year called Beetlejuice, which is the companion podcast to a show he does on Union Jack Radio, which is a really joyous sort of Beatle-themed Sunday morning show, which is hopefully coming back, but yeah, his podcast that he did with his wife, Sarah Barron, is really brilliant too, and he does a fantastic podcast with Ed Miliband as well, called Reasons to Be Cheerful. So we were very grateful for him to give up a bit of his time. Didn't sound like he needed to be too coerced to talk about the Beatles.
Yeah, he says that his mind is basically constantly ticking away with Beatles thoughts anyway.
Yeah.
So you just draw the tap and you know, have a bath in it. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say he's probably our most knowledgeable Beatles guest so far by quite some way.
Possibly, but he wears his learning very lightly, though. He's just, it's the enthusiasm I really like. He does know a great deal of these kind of niche facts, and he's able to pull up these stories, but he just loves chatting about it as well.
Yeah, and it's so sort of passionate and infectious enthusiasm. Mm. It's really, really great. Yeah, when listening back to it, I realised I just started reading Tune In at the beginning, which we talked about a lot, because it's the basis of a lot of the conversations about, you know, the relationship between the four and how it's all there in that in those formative years. And I've just got to, after however many months, they've basically just released Please Please Me.
Oh, right.
So that's how long this... And I'm on page 700.
Yeah. Doesn't the book end with the release of Love Me Do?
Or is it... Sorry, I didn't mean Please Please Me. I meant Love Me Do.
Right.
Idiot. Sorry, guys. I think we've got one of our one-star iTunes reviews is someone getting angry that I got those two confused another time. So please don't do that. But yeah, 700 pages until sort of Ringo joins the band. So it's pretty forensic. But yeah, absolutely. It took me a long time to get into it. And until Hamburg, I must admit, I did find it a little bit of a slog.
Mm.
But now I'm absolutely obsessed with it and dreading it ending. Because,
oh, wow,
it might, well, you know, who knows how long it will be till the next one. But
there's some lovely stories in it, aren't there? I love that one about when they would finish writing a Lennon-McCartney composition. They would have a smoke on Paul's dad's pipe using loose leaf tea. So disgusting. But just to be kind of grown up. I love that.
But there's so much, you know, if you really want to take a deep dive, it's up there with the sort of, you know, Team of Rivals and, you know, Abraham Lincoln biography. It's sort of that comprehensive, with another 2,000 pages to go. So highly recommend it for the hardcore.
Mm.
So we'll crack on with this episode. Actually, you had something you've brought along to show the boys and girls.
Yeah. Well, this is kind of, in the podcast later, I sort of make this kind of like... probably one of the most boring things I've ever said, but I'd be very interested to read a book about how the Beatles learnt chords. You know, like, where did those specific things come from? I think that came from, I'm very interested in the idea of, like, what are they doing consciously and what are they doing unconsciously? Mm. There's a really good book about Shakespeare called Shakespeare's Brain, which is basically about what was seeping into Shakespeare's writing unconsciously. Like, how did his brain actually work? And I think that's the kind of, that, I think that's what I'm trying to get at. You know, I'd mentioned an interview where Paul's asked about Blackbird and whether he was listening and tuning into all the folk stuff. Mm-hmm. And I found the interview. It's from Mojo when on the anniversary of the White Album, I think. So he says Blackbird. You know, there's a great video of him where he's talking about the inspiration from Bach. The interviewer says, "Had you been to any of the folk clubs like the Troubadour?" And he says, "No, I hadn't done any of that. My main influence would have been Bob Dylan in the folky thing and traditional British folk music, but I was not a big fan. It was whatever happened along my way. But I did like the finger-picking style, and it was one of those things I'd always meant to learn. I know Gypsy Dave, David Mills, a musician buddy of Donovan in the 60s. I think he or a mate of his might have taught Donovan the rudiments. Neither John nor I could play that way, but John learned off somebody, Donovan, according to his recollection, and it resulted in Julia, one of my favourite John tracks. I did my own version of finger-picking, which is a bit of a bodge, but it resulted in Blackbird." And I love that because, A, he's describing Blackbird as a bit of a bodge.
Yeah.
Which is, but the amazing thing about that is the way he's downplaying it so much. And also, it still doesn't account for the magic of Blackbird and Julia. Because even having that experience in India and learning some rudiments from Donovan, like, I mean, I've been playing the guitar for like 20 years and I still can't play Julia right. So it's like, how, that's the thing that I'm really interested in, which is, so now I'm going to quote from the Ian Penman article, which was in the London Review of Books early this year, which is absolutely brilliant.
Well worth a read.
Yeah, where he just, it starts one paragraph by saying, "None of this quite explains the tonal and lyrical range soon evinced by the Beatles." And that's the thing. I think that gets to the core of the magic of what I'm talking about, is despite knowing all this stuff and knowing these influences, none of it quite explains the magic that comes from it. You know, and so that's, for me, why I'm just endlessly fascinated by the India period of Julia and Blackbird and what was going on for them to learn that stuff, because it became greater than the sum of its parts.
It is crazy. I mean, that's a really good point about Julia as well, because it's sort of, I've been playing guitar probably the same time as you, and that sort of F9 thing is still a massive struggle.
Yeah.
I've literally been playing that song for 20 years.
I mean, I think Lennon just had incredibly strong fingers. And also, when you listen to there's a nice anthology outtake where he fluffs it and stuff, which is quite nice to hear.
Yeah, well, that's good to know.
Yeah, but there's still magic going on.
They're just like a little new colour that they've, you know, picked up along the way. But the paintings are still, you know, incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just another little weapon in the arsenal. But is all of that well worth investigating?
Yeah, I'm talking my arse off here. It's a bit much, isn't it?
That's all right. If you would, God forbid, want an extended version of this podcast, you can get... this is actually a particularly long one because we were having such a great time, especially towards the end.
Yeah.
So you'll probably get another sort of 20 minutes to maybe even half an hour out of this one if you want to join our Patreon, which you can do by going to patreon.com. Is it Patreon or Patreon?
I don't think it matters, does it?
Patreon. As long as you pay. patreon.com/personalbeatles. And then we'll also give you a monthly bonus podcast, first of which will be arriving next week. Should be fun.
Cool,
If you enjoy the show, please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. That's really helpful for other people finding it and all that jazz. But for now, please enjoy our conversation with the wonderful Jeff Lloyd. So what was the first conscious Beatles exposure then?
I was born in 73, and I think for anybody born around that time, Beatles is almost like nursery rhymes in a way. It doesn't, some of those songs don't feel like they came out of people. They just feel like they're in the in the culture in the way that something like Here We Go Round the Mulberry Bush or My Grandfather's Clock is. And we used to have a man who came into school and played piano and we'd sing When I'm 64. And I don't think I had any idea really that was anything to do with the Beatles. And again, with things like Radio 1 and what little local radio we had back then, they would sort of play everything, the contemporary stuff. Mm. And you'd always hear Beatles songs like She Loves You or I Want to Hold Your Hand. And that was kind of it for me and the Beatles. Paul McCartney was somebody I was aware of because I'd seen him on Saturday morning TV when he got a record to promote and had this association with him and the Frog Chorus. And, you know, again, when I was a teenager, George Harrison, you know, came back with Cloud Nine, and I was very aware of that from being a teenager and watching the chart show. And there was a show called No Limits, which was produced by Jonathan King. I remember seeing the video to Got My Mindset on You on that for the first time. So, and I knew somehow that they had been Beatles, but you know, whatever that thing that a lot of people have of having grown up with them and having sort of awareness of them and, you know, the icons that they were. I didn't really have that. And then when I started working at my first radio station, my boss said one day, have you heard this? And he'd just got a CD reissue of Plastic Ono Band. And I said, I haven't. He said, oh, you want to take it into a studio and listen to it? And I took it into a tiny little booth and put it on really loud. And I was so taken with it. I think I sat in there and listened to it 5-6 times over and over again. And that was the start of it as an obsession for me. You know, that honesty that is in that album because of the Primal Therapy. I just loved it. And from that point, I thought, okay, every week when I get paid, I'm going to go and buy a Beatles album. So yeah. I think I started with Sgt. Pepper and then, you know, worked my way outwards, you know, like a fan either side.
Well, I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? Because that kind of primal, the rawness of that album is not necessarily something you find when you look back through the Beatles stuff. So what were you trying to kind of capture that thing? What was the journey back like as you tried to kind of find that moment?
Well, it's
again,
funny because, you know, I went from there to Sgt. Pepper, which is, you know, very technicolor and very much the opposite of that album. And then I just loved Sgt. Pepper in, I guess, A Day in the Life. There's a through line to John's bits of that. But I just loved everything about it. I mean, I felt like a sponge at that time. Everything that I could listen to or start to find out felt exciting to me. I guess as I've got older, I've made friends with the earlier stuff much more than, you know, I really, really love the first four albums in a way that I didn't, I think, when I started buying them up. It was kind of from Help onwards that I loved. But it was like being a sponge. And I think there's this amazing thing about being a Beatles fan where, firstly, the you know, it's a peerless body of music. There is no greater catalogue of recorded music than what the Beatles made for us. But then the story and what it is to be a fan and what that gives to you as well is so rewarding. And that's almost, you know, people say like the Beatles are full of all these happy accidents, odd coincidences and these chain reactions that they set off. One of the greatest ones is what they give to you as a fan and the world it opens up and what an incredible story it is. But the cast of characters and the facts. I think if you're obsessive about anything, that will open up. But I think the richness of the world of the Beatles is just a glorious thing to be a fan of.
I think that's the thing. Like you go through this phase of getting all the studio albums, and then there's the kind of like lifting up the rock and seeing everything underneath when you get into the backstory and the books about them and the, you know, the bootlegs and anthology, and there's all that other stuff. And like you say, the cast of characters and everything.
And usually Plastic Ono Band comes towards the end of that discovery as well. So it's interesting to sort of reverse into it from...
Yeah, it was a funny way around to do it, yeah.
Was there any particular song on Plastic Ono Band that hit you?
Yeah, I think I just loved it all. I loved God, Mother, Isolation. I mean, I'm just going to sit here and say song titles until we tick off everything from the track listing. There wasn't anything... I mean, My Mummy's Dead, maybe, but there wasn't anything that didn't... you know, grip me in some way or other. And that honesty, and I know you guys have talked about this before, that really, for a young person, John Lennon is often the way into the Beatles because of what a force of nature and somebody who sought out the truth in himself and in the world, how attractive that is to you as a teenager or a young person. Perhaps it was that I was responding to.
We listened to you on the Egg Pod, the brilliant Beatles podcast, and
Chris is great, isn't he?
Yeah. Took a very deep dive into Anthology 2. I just really liked what you were talking about with Yesterday, and I suppose McCartney's character, as opposed to what we were talking about with Lennon, where there's something kind of always a bit obfuscating about McCartney. I wondered how you kind of grew to love McCartney, or how that worked after being introduced by Lennon and everything.
I think at first, like a lot of people, I hadn't clicked that the person singing the song had written the song. And even I remember, very early on, just distinguishing the voices was difficult to me, which there's such... I mean, one of the amazing things about the Beatles is that you have... I mean, two of the greatest instruments in rock and roll are Paul McCartney's voice and John Lennon's voice. And the fact that they coexist in a band is incredible. And of course, George's voice is great as well. And the way it blends with their voices is so special. So unpicking what was Paul and what was John wasn't something I even thought about very much to begin with. And did you see that piece that went viral on Twitter maybe a couple of months ago?
Yeah.
Which was in some ways a love letter to Paul. I think it was written by Ian Leslie.
Yes, yeah.
Does that sound right?
Yeah, it was just before 3 came out, wasn't it? Yeah, it was.
Yes,
it was kind of about 70 things about him.
Oh yeah, that was so great.
Yeah, and there was this line about how in this country we can sometimes treat him not as if he is one of the greatest artists or part of the greatest contribution to 20th century culture that this country had to offer, but we can treat him like some cheesy guy who used to host a game show. And I do think, you know, at the time there was a little bit of that perception of Paul which was so unfair, really. And I don't know if you've seen, I forget her name, there's a historian who has written a book, and she's on a couple of Beatles podcasts about the Beatles story from a historian's point of view, and about actually how the John Lennon narrative of him as genius and Paul as saccharine, which was really established in those early 70s interviews that John did, became the received wisdom, you know, through Philip Norman's Shout to some extent and the Albert Golden book. And it was only when we ended up with a historian as forensic and as committed to telling the story more accurately as Mark Lewisohn is, that narrative shifted. So I think when I started listening to the Beatles, there was still a little bit of a hangover of that perception of Paul. But yeah, you listen to the records and there's just nothing in the records that backs that up. And actually, the more you know the story...
Exactly, yeah.
And especially, you know, it's so surprising to me that the type of person who writes him off is generally the type of person who writes off anything the Beatles did before they stopped touring. So in other words, the sort of people who will say, yeah, well, they were just a boy band to begin with, and then they got good. And when they talk about then they got good, most of what they're talking about was driven by Paul's love for that band and his ambition to open the band up to different ways of working and you know, always do it differently to the last thing that they did. And I just think he's phenomenal. I love him. I'm fascinated by him as an individual as well. I think to have lived the life he has lived and still put such a priority on being normal and being nice is without precedent. Now, I'm not saying that Paul McCartney is just a normal man, because that is impossible. But the fact that his values are such that that has remained important to him and it's something he comes back to, it's just phenomenal. I'm fascinated by the fact that you've got these four guys from similar-ish backgrounds. You know, Paul and George, definitely. Ringo a bit poorer, John a bit posher. But similar backgrounds, and the ways in which they handled the fame and, you know, what their lives looked like in a certain sense. It's really interesting. They're all from similar backgrounds. They experienced this same thing, and yet how it affected them is so different. And I think, you know, when you dig into that, there is something about the values that were instilled in Paul by his family and the importance to him of holding on to those values. That's just incredibly impressive. I find it insane that, you know, George Harrison made some money and moved into a castle, and you know, John Lennon made some money and moved into a, you know, Tittenhurst, but also out in the suburbs, and Ringo as well. Very stereotypically what rock stars from that background do when they get a bit of money. Yeah. And yet Paul was not just content to stay in his girlfriend's parents' spare room, but if you look at the life he has led and continues to lead to this day, yes, he lives in some of the, and has houses in some of the most spectacular locations in the world, but he lives pretty modestly. He doesn't live in a big country pile. What does that say about him? What does that say about his need to stay grounded, that he lives in the context of a pretty much a billionaire in quite modest surroundings? It's fascinating to me.
It's almost an interesting sort of social experiment that you do have those four very similar people and just see how much they, you know, how differently they choose. I think they all kind of ended up where they wanted to be.
Yeah.
And where they ended up kind of without the sort of element of tragedy.
But
Paul just definitely, he is the one that you kind of relate with. And he's been so relentlessly nice, and being nice is something that comes in and out of fashion. I think hopefully we're sort of over the hump of the kind of anti-Macca sort of tabloidy, you know, game show figurey. I think I hope we're on the home straight now of people's just starting to appreciate.
I think so.
Exactly how incredible it is that someone like that is A, still with us, and B, sort of reassess the, you know, the damage that was done from the fallout from the early 70s. And then also, you know, after Lennon getting sort of martyred for music fans, you know, Paul paid the price for that as well.
And I don't think he's an uncomplicated, character at all. And I don't think what we see of Paul is in any way phony, but I also think that he, at quite a young age, and he tells us a story, which is an interesting one, which you've probably heard him tell a dozen times because he wheels it out in interviews with some frequency. But he tells this story about, I think, going on holiday to Greece and it being the only place the Beatles haven't sold any records. So I think him and Ringo would go there first couple of years and enjoy some anonymity. And that was his bolt hole. And then he goes back one year and they're number one and everybody's making a fuss of him. And he talks about, and I don't know how true it is, making a conscious decision at that point. He thinks, well, either I step back from it and there is some semblance of a normal life at some point in the future, or I just accept that it's a good thing. The pros outweigh the cons, and just try and live that life and enjoy it. And I think that's an oversimplification, because I think also in that there was this decision to hold a lot of himself back for himself.
Mm.
And I think the Paul that his friends or his family know, or people who work with him to some extent, it's a much fuller and more complicated, for better and for worse, character than what we know as the public. But it's really remarkable how, to him, that the part of him that he doesn't hold back has had this priority on being nice and being reasonable and having these values around what constitutes a normal life. I think it speaks incredibly well of him. I think he's a much more three-dimensional figure than that. But I really respect the choice he has made to hold the other dimensions back for himself. I think it's helped him keep his sanity.
Going to ask you about is when you were first suggested that we get you on, we were, I have to say, quite intimidated by your unbelievable Beatle knowledge, because Robin and I often feel like frauds on this on this podcast, because there are always people with like better sort of knowledge than you. But as someone who has, you know, the Beatles incorporated into your sort of professional life, in the radio show that you do and stuff, and we found it a little bit in the first series, is how do you get rid of sort of Beatle fatigue? Because we find that I've had this in my sort of normal life before we started doing this, where I'd have kind of phases of getting in and into the Beatles, and then I wouldn't listen to them for quite a long time. But how do you ever have phases where the gum sort of loses its taste and you have to have a bit of time off?
I feel that it's such a rich body of work, and then especially if you kind of add the solo work onto it, that there's always something. I mean, it's not what I put on every time I look through my phone and think, what am I going to beam to the Sonos system? But I don't think a week goes by without me, you know, putting on an album or a song at some point. And I've got a 4.5-year-old son, so I'm desperately trying to indoctrinate him as well, you know, which, you know, you've got to do carefully. Although my wife, I was up here in the attic doing something the other day, and Sarah came up and she said, "Is Paul McCartney left-handed?" I said, "Yeah." And she said, "I was just talking to Eugene, who's our son, and I'd mentioned something about not holding his pen in his left hand because he's right-handed." He goes, "No, I'm left-handed like Paul." And yeah, I am imposing not only the music but also the trivia to the extent my 4.5-year-old son knows that Paul McCartney is left-handed.
Yeah. And so we'll have to talk about, what was it like? I mean, you've interviewed Paul several times. I mean, do you remember the first time you did and how that felt? And, you know, I suppose, how was it meeting him and kind of without collapsing?
I know. Well, prior to that, I remember when I lived in Manchester and I had this job on the Mrs. Merton show as a runner, but also had friends who worked for Granada TV. So we would quite often just go and hang out at TV recordings so we could go in the green room afterwards and get free booze. And I remember going to, I think it was an episode of That Show Business with Mike Smith, which was a TV panel show quiz. But it may have also been, you know, my memories of the 90s are a little unclear due to my poor relationship with alcohol at the time, but it might have also been Noddy Holder's This Is Your Life recording. I remember going to one of those two shows, and Mike McCartney, as in Mike McGear, Paul's brother, was there, and getting to talk to him and just feeling, when I went home that night, oh my God, I've just spoken to a Beatles brother. That is it now. I've got close to a Beatle. I played it cool and didn't ask questions about Paul, much as I would have liked to. But that felt like, okay, well, that was my thing at coming close to a Beatle. And then, you know, a couple of years after that, I think I interviewed Sean Lennon when he had an album out when I was on local radio. And, you know, if anything, that felt even more exciting. He told me an interesting thing. I think at the time, you know, he was a young man and he was obviously wrangling with some difficult stuff. But he told me in this interview that he used to carry a medal in his pocket, and that if somebody came up to him and said, "Oh, I really loved your dad's music," he'd get this medal out and say, "Oh, do you want a medal then, do you?" You know, it just seems very harsh. Antithesis of how Paul would handle a fan. And yet at the same time, you know, obviously his life has been very difficult for the obvious reason. But then it didn't occur to me really that I'd get any closer to a Beatle than that. And then when I started at Virgin Radio in London, this was 99, and Paul had done an album of rock and roll covers. It was as he was grieving for Linda, and the story certainly at the time was that he wanted to revisit this music that she loved. And we got an invitation to go to the album launch for this thing. But the only problem was it was while I was on air, it coincided with the show I was doing at the time, which was an evening show. I was so desperate to just go to this party where I'd be in the same room as Paul McCartney without telling anybody. We put the middle hour of the show on tape and then decided to sneak out, just leaving this tape going around. And we went to this party.
And then 9/11 happened.
I went in, and as I entered this party, I bumped into somebody I knew and they started talking to me. My co-host and producer had gone on ahead, and I could see in the distance that somebody had introduced them to Paul McCartney. And I just thought that was it. That was my chance. They're talking to him. I'm not. So I sort of very rudely bolted past this friend of mine, bolted into that group just as Paul was leaving, and then, like an idiot, grabbed his hand and went, "Yeah, it was nice to meet you," even though I just sort of turned up breathlessly. And I thought that was going to be it. And then a couple of days later, we got the call saying, "Would you like to have Paul on the show?" Which was how it ended. It always ended up being like that. There was never very much notice in any of the interviews that I did. And I did quite a lot over the years, maybe 15 or 16, something like that. Wow. And it was often the day before, sometimes the day of, can you get yourself around to Paul's office in Soho Square? And being a fan, you know, I knew about the MPL offices and I'd walk past and, you know.
Yeah. I always slow my pace when I walk past.
Just in case.
In case I see him pop out.
Yeah. And we got shown to that office you will have seen in his interviews, and you know, the jukebox in there and all the paintings and some great Linda photography on the walls. I think the one from the Sgt. Pepper photo is from Sgt. Pepper party is up there, and we're just sat, and then we hear him coming and he's durdering to himself, and that's weird because not only is Paul McCartney approaching, but Paul McCartney is approaching and singing, and it was just great, and he was so lovely with us. I don't remember much about it. I remember one of the questions I asked is like, what's best, the first note of A Hard Day's Night or the last note of She Loves You? So what do you think he said?
I mean, I personally, because it's a sting on this podcast, would go for The Hard Day's Night.
Yeah, that's what he went for, rather than the jazzy chord that they thought they'd invented with the harmonies at the end. Yeah. But he was just great. And then, you know, over the years, whenever there was something new, like say we'd get the call, or I'd get the call when I then went to do a solo radio show.
That's because of the relationship that you had with him, or is that just?
Yeah, well, you know, he for whatever reason he enjoyed it, and it's funny because, like, nobody is more some people are, but yeah, there are a few people as obsessive about the Beatles as I am, and there are few people as in awe of Paul McCartney as a talent and as a human being. But, you know, I always felt I've got to keep him engaged, and I've got to see if I can stop him from saying what he's going to say in every other interview. Yeah. Because that's another thing that he does, and it's clever. Again, it's about, you know, that thing of holding himself back that we talked about before. I think that's part of it. So he has a good story. That line Lennon had about him being a great PR man. He always has the angle to tell you about the album, and he also has the knack. And I've seen it happen to loads of interviews and interviewers, and I've sometimes fallen foul of it, where when he's telling you, you feel like you're the only person to hear this thing. Being, you know, with McCartney 3, it got to a point where somebody said, oh, did you hear Paul McCartney on such and such a show, or did you see such and such? And I'd text back saying, oh, yeah, did his was his daughter Mary staying with him, and would he go off to the studio and then come back and play what he'd done that day while she cooked? And people would text back saying, oh, my God, have you heard it already? I said, no, that's just what he's saying in every interview.
So it doesn't sort of feel like he's on autopilot. He feels very engaged.
What he seems to like is a bit of irreverence, not too much, but a bit of irreverence. And actually, it's so often the case as an interviewer anyway, if you ask people almost quite dull questions about their everyday life, it's more illuminating than asking them about a record, and especially with somebody like Paul, who has got his stuff that he wants to say about the record, or he's got his prepared, so he knows he can give a good interview. Just knowing that he watches Would I Lie to You is more interesting.
I'd rather hear one story about Holmes Under the Hammer than B7 on the bus for the 10 millionth time.
Yeah, and it's getting those kind of details out of him, which I think he enjoys anyway, because I think if you can catch him right, that he feels that's more like an authentic conversation anyway, perhaps. Did either of you watch, it wasn't very long, but I thought it was great, was the Chris Rock one he did ahead of some video YouTube premiere for McCartney 3, and it was just the two of them talking. It was funny because Paul was on a Zoom, and he was far less put together, as it were, than he has been on, say, the Idris Elba interview or some of the other ones we've seen. But I think it can be really good watching him talk to somebody that he feels is similar to him status-wise, which in a way nobody is, because he's Paul McCartney. But I think he's quite in awe of comedians. And he's really good if you ever hear him on Howard Stern as well. Howard Stern over the years has morphed into, I mean, he was always a good interviewer, but that's not what you necessarily thought of him as. But he's morphed into this celebrity interviewer who I think is without peer. Paul goes on that show quite often, and you do get well-trod anecdotes, but you also see this different side of him, because I think there is a way that he can relate to people at his level that is different to dealing with, a somewhat nervous fan, even if that somewhat nervous fan is a very accomplished broadcaster or actor or musician or whatever.
I think there's that thing sometimes he does. There was an interview, maybe it was Mojo or Uncut or something, and I think sometimes with the big musos, he can be quite deflating. Like, I think someone wanted to know something about, because of Blackbird and Mother Nature's Son, were you listening to a lot of the English folk that was going round? And he was just like, no, not at all. just very kind of, bringing you back down to earth. You want this to be true, that he was kind of hanging out with Bert Jansch or something.
It just wasn't.
I think he seems to have a similar thing when he gets asked about anything in Revolution the Head, where he just doesn't really, if it countenance, it's just like, no, that didn't happen. What didn't happen like that? if you put words in his mouth, he doesn't seem to have any sort of time for it whatsoever.
Not at all. Not at all, actually. I also think, I love how he is. I think in a way he hides it, but I think every band has a member who is the fan of the band. And I think in the Beatles it's Paul, and of course you see that in what he did for them and how he drove them in the second half of the career. But I do think the story of it is important to him. I think he is too savvy or too modest to talk about it that much. And he's also very careful not to, even though it's inevitable to live off the glories of the Beatles, because how couldn't you? But he's very careful not to be Mr. Retro Paul, I'll talk about anything to do with the 60s. He's very, you know, his strategy and the people he works with are brilliant in terms of how they position in him. He's always got a new thing and a new project. And he's not just somebody who you wheel out to talk about reissues.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
thing is when he does his most interesting work, as well as when he's working with people on a similar status, if not like higher status, which is it when I think when you read about the way that Nigel Godrich was with him in the studio when they made Chaos and Creation, is that they actually locked horns quite a bit, and Nigel Godrich didn't really take much shit from him and told him when things were awful. And I think that sort of not being surrounded by sycophants really makes him sort of up his game a bit. Yeah, it must be just so boring for him going on sort of Jimmy Fallon or something.
Yeah, and is there anything worse than seeing those American talk show hosts do impersonations of him?
Of any Beatle in general, I just find absolutely
the way that Paul is able to grin and bear that, I think, you know, that is a great reflection on him as well. The fact that he can be good humoured in the face of Jimmy Fallon's impersonations.
Yeah, that's up there with Hey Jude.
Yeah.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So interested in the dynamics of the band and the relation, the interband relationships, and what held it together, and why it came apart, and then, you know, what continued throughout the 70s and beyond, you know, especially in the case of George and Paul. And when I think about which one of you is reading Tune In at the moment, the extended edition.
Yeah, I've just started. Yeah. Well, I'm about sort of 100 pages in. Yeah,
it's all there. It's all in that dynamic between John and Paul and George. This cool older kid who's a force of nature, who, in some ways, against his better judgment, when being cool and rebellious, lets this younger kid into his band, but because he can see it's such a smart thing to do. But Paul knows how talented he is as well, so he's there on merit. And then Paul doing George the favour of letting him audition for John, and then John making that same compromise again, letting this young boy, this child really, into his band. Think what the difference is between, I don't know, a 16-year-old and a 13-year-old or whatever it was. And just how much that dynamic underpins everything that happens subsequently. And actually the reason that in some ways Ringo was the most popular Beatle in the Beatles is because he didn't bring that baggage to it. He just came in after they'd lived those years of that around Liverpool and Hamburg. That power dynamic is really interesting to me, and especially the way it plays out with Paul and George throughout the 80s and 90s.
Yeah. I think as well, when you listen to Sergeant Pepper, I think that's the one where you can hear them getting on. Like, that's the peak of them getting on, in a way. Like, I think part of the magic of Pepper is the fact that Lennon is doing stuff like Mr. Kite, which is stuff he would definitely move away from. Although he was always quite fond of that song, I think.
But yeah.
That was definitely a direction he'd move away. So it was like the reason that kind of indefinable magic of what's really good about Sgt. Pepper is the fact that they were really socially bonded at that point somehow. Maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so.
I think to the extreme, in that wasn't there around that period where they just couldn't deal with not being with each other, and they would just sort of rent out a massive mansion and end up all sitting in the same room.
You're for thinking of Help.
The whole weekend. Is that that period?
No, I meant the film Help.
I remember it's sort of later than you think when they're just sort of, they're so inseparable, but not. In a kind of sort of codependent way that isn't necessarily that healthy.
Yeah, I guess I have that the peak of that down being slightly earlier. I kind of think of that as being Rubber Soul Revolver, but I think you're right, because if you think about 67 and them all, one of them couldn't become interested in meditation.
Yeah.
You know, one finds out about it and then all of them have to go to Bangor and all of them have to go to India. And there's that famous Mick Jagger quote about them being like a four-headed monster. Mm. And what being the only people who knew what it felt like did to the bonds between them is, I mean, it's unknowable. But I think, yeah, that when you talk about that, I think being stuck in the middle of that hurricane then meant when they weren't touring anymore, it just felt like that's how they had to move through the world to some extent. Mm. And then you hear Paul talk about the peer pressure, for example, around taking acid. One of us has done it, so we all have to do it, and he's got his doubts. I think you're right, and it is after that, especially as John becomes infatuated with and gets to know Yoko Ono, but also like a little bit before that with when he's off filming How I Won the War. Yeah. That it's starting, you know, that period, kind of 66, 67, that there is a bit of them dipping their toe in the waters of doing their own thing.
Yeah, and certainly... Yeah, I mean, thinking about what I just said, I mean, on Revolver, you can start to see some fractures, maybe. But I just think on Sgt. Pepper, John's really prepared to play the game, you know, with Mr. Kite and with maybe Good Morning or so. You know, he's prepared to be daft. I mean, he's always daft. I don't know what I'm trying to say.
He seems a bit removed from the kind of the process. I think there was... a lot of him sort of stepping back and letting Paul sort of create his vision.
Yeah.
Part of because he was so fucked on acid that he wasn't sort of capable of running the show. So it is kind of the changing of the guard a lot, that record.
Yeah.
Which is why I find it interesting that you say you go from like Plastic Ono Band and then getting into Sgt. Pepper. Is that that's the most sort of removed, sort of abstract John stuff, you know, better Mr. Kite and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. I mean, it's a million miles away from burying your soul on the acetate.
Yeah. It's difficult to pin down what they thought of Sgt. Pepper in a certain way, especially John, who sometimes when you read those 70s interviews, you get the impression he thinks it's a sort of overproduced horror show. And yet, in How Do You Sleep, there is the suggestion that he was the one who knew that the leap forward was Sgt. Pepper, and Paul was surprised by it, even though Paul was the driver of it in this way. And then the kind of tearing it up, in essence, when they recorded the White Album and going the other way. It's difficult to know, but just having interviewed musicians a lot over the years, I think, you know, the point at which an album has come out and the year or two after that, it's very difficult for musicians to have perspective on their own work because they've heard it nonstop. They, you know, can't get any perspective on it. In their heads, they've already moved on to the next thing and maybe feel slightly embarrassed by it. But, you know, I think over the years, And again, it comes back to that thing of Paul being the big Beatles fan in the Beatles. I think Paul has loved that album and was involved like in the 25th anniversary celebrations. As I think, you know, the others might have been George and Ringo. I can't remember the South Bank show special. But anyway, like I feel that all of them apart from Paul have to different degrees been disparaging about it, but also have recognised just what a moment it was and how important it felt in terms of the leap forward at the time.
Yeah, I think it took a long time for that dust to settle and the sort of reappraisal of that record. Because when I remember growing up, that was the masterpiece. Was Sergeant Pepper. Whereas now that's sort of quite a, I don't know whether it's like an old-fashioned opinion or it's just an unfashionable opinion. But now, like, you know, you never really meet anyone whose favourite Beatles record is Sergeant Pepper. It seems to be that Revolver or Abbey Road now.
Yeah, I think that changed. I think that started to shift a little bit with the reissue. I think... Yeah, they've done an amazing job of these reissues. And I think the Sgt. Pepper one, it did feel as if we'd gone through this long period of it being almost uncool to say, oh, Sgt. Pepper's a great album, and more to, you know, just talk about the artifice of it. I think, you know, when people were given the chance to reappraise it, and especially actually, I mean, it's funny, the Ringo's parts and Paul's parts, you know, the drums and the bass, which sound incredible on those remasters.
Yeah,
and it does beg the question, is that because the surviving members of the Beatles just said, can you turn me up a bit? But I think that has shifted. I know what you're talking about, but I think it's shifted a little bit. Although I do agree, I think you'd be hard pushed to find somebody who'd stick the neck out and say, oh, no, it's Sergeant Pepper for me. Even though I think it's a really valid opinion to have.
I mean, you're always biased by the ones that first sort of blow your mind.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I got into Revolver a little bit later in my sort of, I was probably 17, 18 before I got into Revolver. But I always saw Revolver and Rubber Soul as sort of two sides of the same coin in the interim between mop top pop group Beatles and the phenomenal musical genius Beatles or whatever. That was the narrative that I sort of had in my head from the records that I had access to and stuff. So never would have occurred to me that anyone would think Revolver is the de facto best Beatle record until Mojo came out.
Yeah, but you were saying, you know, during that 90s Britpop period where you got into the Beatles, that was very much the thing. All the NME Melody Makers sounds at the time, if they did the greatest album of all time, it was always Revolver. That was the one. I like the bit in Anthology, the documentary, where George can't remember which songs are on Rubber Soul and which ones are on Revolver. It all kind of blurs into one for him. I think just in what were you saying before about them as a unit, for me, like the peak of them functioning as a unit, I think is Rubber Soul. That's when it seems to be the perfect blend of tightness and all pulling in the same direction, and, you know, it, at least the studio side of it, being fun. But what's funny is you look at the recording date, you know, the dates for that album, and they were scrabbling to get enough tracks to fill a record.
Yeah, for a Christmas record.
Yeah, and they taped that instrumental 12-bar thing just in case they couldn't finish the album and they needed something to fill it out, which is astonishing, because here we are thinking about Rubber Soul, one of, you know, the greatest albums of the greatest band, and they were scrabbling to make up the numbers of tracks.
Do you have a favourite then, if you had to pick?
Or I don't.
Favourite period?
Yeah, I just love it all, and it shifts so much. I think, implausible though it might be, if to save the human race, only one Beatles record could survive, maybe it'd be Abbey Road. But I just, you know, there's just so much to love in all of them, really.
Play the piano a bit, don't you?
Yeah, not really. you know, not really.
Have you ever kind of just got into the Beatles from that more musical perspective, or to kind of worked out songs and kind of?
Yeah, but I'm really ham-fisted, and I learn things from watching YouTube videos, I can only look at the... I can't play guitar, but I can't read the music, so I look at the guitar chords and then try and guess what I should be doing with my fingers to work out where the melody is, and you know, fill it out with chord notes. I don't know what I'm doing, really, respect.
Yeah.
But I do like, you know, I loved... when Rock Band came out and somebody, you know, did a jailbreak on the multi-tracks, and then you could get those stems, I think they call them now, and put them into a computer program and then isolate the different things. Like, I'm obsessed with the Beatles harmonies, even though I'm not a terrible singer. You know, I love karaoke, but I'm a terrible singer. But I will sit for... my wife goes on TV because of her job sometimes, and... a while ago, somebody had come round to do her hair and makeup. And I heard this woman in the kitchen say to my wife, "Oh, does your husband work in the music industry?" And she said, "No, he doesn't. No, this is just something he does." And it's so much part of my life that if I just am doing nothing, I'm on YouTube watching that. I think he's an Italian fella who teaches you how to sing the Beatles harmonies. Right. I was sort of sitting down there in a rabbit hole of listening to them. And I love it, you know, on bootlegs or isolated tracks. Just, you know, there's the Penny Lane on the Sgt. Pepper's reissue. There's an a cappella take, or just a vocal take, I should say, just a vocal track of Penny Lane. And you can hear them kind of figuring out harmonies, which are then discarded. I will sit and listen to the hand claps and the bits of conversation. I find it so thrilling what is there on the tapes.
Yeah,
definitely. Like, especially the sort of Sun King and Because, and
it's their
sort of three part close harmony.
But also the sense that it wasn't coming from a theory background. Mm. It was about like, oh, you do this, you do this, and just trying it out. And you know, it was.
Yeah, I've always wondered how they
complicated things,
how they do it, and how you sort of, I mean, because I think. Weirdly, I don't know if this is a sort of revolution in the head thing that's just made up, but isn't John Lennon said it was Moonlight Sonata backwards or something like that?
Yeah, I think that's the...
But having tried to go back to the piano and look at that the other day, there's no way that's true.
No, but they were,
not,
you know...
It's not anywhere near it, but...
But they were magpies. So John, the story goes that he'd heard Yoko playing that on piano because she's this classically trained pianist. And I think being, as John said about My Sweet Lord, I mean, his opinion was George had ripped it off and he just hadn't done a good enough job of covering his tracks. And I think the Beatles would find inspiration, you know, and then cover their tracks really well. Yeah, that Bobby Parker song, Watch Your Step. Have you heard that one?
No, I don't. It's
a great record, and it was on John Lennon and George Harrison's jukeboxes. And you listen to it, and you can sort of hear whatever's going on with the guitar riff in stuff like I Feel Fine, Paperback Writer, Day Tripper. It's in a way, it's just variations of this record. They were really clever.
There was that great program a few years ago about John's jukebox, wasn't there?
And I think there was maybe a radio program on George's jukebox as well, and there's somebody has made a Spotify playlist of all the stuff that's in there. And that, you know, that is fascinating to me as well, because I just think our reason that the Beatles exist at this different level in terms of their body of work than all their contemporaries, even though their contemporaries are like the Stones, for example, are responsible for some of the greatest records ever made, is that there was a coolness to them and they loved their rock and roll, but there was also sort of this uncoolness to them. Not just, you know, Paul's dad's got some old sheet music on his piano or played in a jazz band, but just this scrabbling to fill a set, or, you know, listening to I'm Wishing from Snow White and then thinking, oh, we could rip that off somehow. They weren't just plundering rock and roll or rhythm and blues records. They were plundering everything, and it made them just so much broader as a band and what they did musically than their contemporaries.
We were talking about this kind of before you popped on, we started recording, but we were talking about how sort of Paul, through kind of osmosis, just picks up on very sort of a lot of very sort of baroque-y techniques. So from the sort of baroque kind of classical sort of first Viennese school of, as you would learn it in if you did a music degree.
Right.
He just picks these little things out, whether it's a sort of Alberti bass in his left hand or the way that he fuses sort of contrapuntal, barky kind of fugal melodies. But he obviously doesn't know what any of that stuff is, but he's just had this incredible ability to sort of pluck it out of the ether.
That's what I find this really interesting, because we were talking about the vocal harmonies, and with vocal harmonies, you don't need to know music theory. You can say, this sounds nice, let's do this. And you can create, like, you know, because or something like that, very intricate harmony. But what I think this would be a really interesting book is, how did the Beatles learn guitar chords? I mean, you could start with the obvious story about getting the bus, etc.
Yeah.
To learn B7. But by the time, literally, where were they learning the chords? Like complicated chords, augmented chords, diminished chords, minor sevenths and sixths. I mean, how did you learn the guitar in the 60s? There must have been a big book of chords. I don't know,
because it's not like you could, you know, they would talk about seeing people play guitar on screen and watching their fingers to check they were really playing. Yeah. But it's not like now where you could pause a performance on a YouTube video. Or even, you know, back 20 or 30 years ago, you'd really see enough on TV to be able to decode it. That's quite an interesting question.
That's got to be just ear, though, because they are growing up in the 50s where, you know, it's not all rock and roll. It's not, you know, most people are listening to sort of Ted Heath's big band and Duke Ellington and swing music and kind of jazzy chords. So most of it, those kind of jazzy ninths and augmented chords that and diminished sevenths especially.
Yeah, like, but I think there's a really interesting thing to think about by, obviously, at the time of the White Album, when Lennon and McCartney were writing separately. There are really interesting points where, say, like, I mean, I was just thinking about this earlier, but in Cry Baby Cry is a lovely descending line, which is like E minor major seven. This is really dull, sorry. E minor seven, E minor six. And it's just going down chromatically. And that's really like McCartney. So it's like, I wonder if McCartney showed him that chord, you know, because Eleanor Rigby's got this descending thing. And that's,
it's amazing,
McCartney.
To me that they got good on piano, you know, that they became accomplished. Paul became accomplished enough on piano to knock out Lady Madonna.
Yes, yeah, which is amazing.
And it's really interesting, that, isn't it? Because at what point do those chords start to become more complicated? Is it when they're in London and there is a scene and they're knocking about with people and they'd be kind of figure? I think sort of figuring out that competitiveness, figuring out what other people are doing is part of it. I also think, you know, that they were just curious people. Paul, incredibly curious. So I think Paul would have asked George Martin a lot of questions. I think Paul would have asked Jane Asher's mum a lot of questions. Isn't there some famous story that Paul wants to find out about the, you know, the anti, what's going on in Vietnam? So he just finds out
Buxton podcast.
He just turns up there. So I just think that they were like sponges, weren't they?
I think John Lennon, isn't there a story John Lennon George Martin had to explain that different brass instruments are in different keys or something.
Yeah. And with the harmonies, I mean, even as late as something like Because, George Martin was working out, I think, though, that level, that nine-part harmony, George Martin was working that out. But I think some of the other stuff that you're talking about, when you're saying how did they do it, it was just intuitive. It's like what they call sibling harmony.
Yeah, that's true.
I think that's sort of... The unbelievable thirst for the B7 on the bus is just something that never left.
And it
just became more and more complex, and he wanted to, you know, explore more and more sort of mad.
But that's one of the great things we can learn from them, I think, you know, to apply to your life. They didn't find a sound and then think, oh, this is a sound we're going to stick with. Pretty much everything was ripping up the thing that came before it.
They
were always thinking, okay, we've done that, what's next? And I love that. And I think that presumably, in terms of the technical skills you're talking about and the craft of the music, presumably that's coming from the same place.
We've
used that B7 now.
Yeah.
What else is out there?
That's like, to go back to Cry Baby Cry, do you know the Isha demo of Cry Baby Cry? Where it's like, in the coda, it turns into a waltz.
She's old enough to know better, so cry, baby, cry, cry, baby, cry, make your mother sigh. She's old enough to know better, so cry, baby, cry, baby, cry.
And it's like, how complicated do you want to make this? It's just ridiculous. You know? It's like that, you said that Ian McDonald quote about Lennon sometimes being crabbed, like he's trying to cram too much stuff in, his writing being crabbed, you know.
Yeah.
And that's, it's interesting, like Lennon seemed to be obsessed with that over-complexity sometimes. But then that's weird because that seems very contrary to the kind of mother kind of simplicity, rawness, directness.
Yeah, but isn't that just part of what we love about him?
And I think
this thing, I've heard Mark Lewisohn talk about how this idea that John said one thing one day and then a completely different thing another is slightly overplayed. But there's an impatience, there's a restlessness to him, I think, which is kind of what's behind that, perhaps.
That's it in a nutshell, isn't it? Is that sort of artistic hunger and restlessness is the story of how they achieved so much and why the Beatles are the Beatles. Like, that's the one defining thing, really, isn't it?
Yeah,
that...
and also, again, to come back to that dynamic of the three of them, George, Paul and John, I think whatever the dysfunction was that lay in that being... these, you know, because they were tough. If you think about what life was like in Hamburg or what life was like around some of those halls in Liverpool where the fights break out and stories about John and violence, they were all tough in a way that that Brian Epstein maybe sort of smoothed off the rough edges a little bit, but there's a kind of macho toughness, which I think in terms of their dynamic, the three of them, and more Lennon McCartney than anything, you couldn't bring something crap in. You couldn't bring something embarrassing in.
Yeah.
Because I don't think they would ever... I think Paul said in some interview that John only ever complimented him once. But maybe about here, there and everywhere. I forget. I'm not sure that's right. But I don't think they were emotionally functional in a nurturing way. But I think they were emotionally dysfunctional in a way that you couldn't bring shit in because it was too embarrassing.
And there would always be something waiting in the wings, presumably, as well, if your track wasn't up to scratch.
Yeah.
I'll just finish off by asking you our stock question, which is, what's your controversial Beatles opinion?
I don't even know it's that controversial, but I mean, the one song that would go on the bonfire for me is Piggies.
Oh, really?
I really hate it. I think it's such an overwrought piece of social commentary that thinks it's so much cleverer than it is.
Right.
I just can't... I find it really hard to deal with George's moany songs.
I think... For me, it's more the Manson association makes it a bit of a grisly listen sometimes.
Well, it makes it icky, but I think it's more... It's just... I mean, I have, you know, Taxman and a lot of his solo stuff that I have a similar problem with. It's just so... It's just for someone who's so sort of enlightened, it's such a sort of glaring lack of perspective.
We've barely talked about him. I mean, he's so fascinating, the contrast between this very spiritual man who you listen to, Olivia, and she talks about, like, dying well, like being at a point where he could... die well was his goal in life. Yeah, and all that, and all the sort of bitterness around money and other people making money off them and holding grudges. And yet the sense that the people who loved him thought there was no better friend to have. If you ever read Tom Petty talking about George Harrison, or, you know, Eric Idle, Michael Palin, the love these people had for him, and the sense that he was so deeply kind and funny, he just seems like such a bunch of contradictions.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the great George Paul schism, I tend to be on Team Paul, I think. Because I think George, yeah, I'm sure, and there are, you know, there are things we know about that if you were George Harrison or Ringo Starr in the 80s or Yoko, there are ways in which Paul conducted himself in terms of business, which certainly on the face of it could really get you back up and obviously cause these huge arguments. But I just the snidiness, the way in which George, kind of after John's death, took it upon himself to be the one who publicly sniped at Paul, when Paul, you know, I think he could be a difficult person to be in a band in, and I think for nobody more than George Harrison, but I really think any time you see Paul interacting with George, he's just trying. He's on eggshells. He's trying so hard, only for George to slap him down repeatedly. But I think, you know, but I do think that, you know, they loved each other. You know, again, these are complicated relationships with very, very deep roots.
I mean, it's hard enough now, sort of, you know, dealing with my group of mates from school is, you know, we have exactly the same things that really fucked us off in the fourth form. It's just slightly exacerbated if you're a Beatle. Yeah.
And if you want to understand the Beatles, that's what you have to understand.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's like, you know, I wake up in the night regretting something I said in 1995. You know, McCartney's like that. Would Let It Be, and so he does Let It Be Naked. You know, that's how you deal with those. You know, it must be like that on a grandiose scale. You know,
and
to feel.
Isn't it lovely? I think, and I think it's genuine. I think part of it is the thing we started off by talking about, the way that Paul will bring to any publicity round a story, and obviously the story he's lining up for Get Back is how refreshing it has been for him to see that relationship in a different light and be able to make peace with the memory. But I don't think that's entirely a fabrication either. I think as the fan of the Beatles and in the band, and as the one who perhaps is more concerned with the legacy than the others, I think Paul is aware of the different narratives that have emerged. Our own memories aren't reliable narrators. There's that thing that actually your memory is just a memory of the last time you had the memory. So it's like, you know, a VHS tape. Every time you copy it, gets worse and worse and worse. And I do think there's been something about both the Ron Howard film and the Peter Jackson film, which I'm so excited about, which has given Paul some peace, or to be all American, closure. with memories that have been difficult for him.
Yeah. So that was the brilliant Jeff Lloyd. Thank you very much, Jeff, for joining us. Really enjoyed that one.
Yeah, it was a great episode. I realised listening back this thing I was talking about where I was trying to pin down something quite vague, which is that I feel that Sergeant Pepper was the last time they really got on.
Yeah.
But I realised afterwards that obviously it's a kind of Brian Epstein thing, isn't it? You know, that and I think you can, I think that is one of the things you can hear in Pepper is that just is the like the innocence before that, I think, you know. And I think that's maybe the thing I was groping towards somewhat. Yeah. But yeah.
No, I think, yeah, I would agree with that. So, yeah, some really great stuff. It's great to talk to him about interviewing Paul and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Obviously dealt with it a lot better than either of us ever would.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you can probably find those Paul? Interviews.
Yeah, what would you ask Paul? I mean...
Well, I think about this probably twice a day. And I'm still none the wiser.
Okay.
I think, I mean, reading a lot of Tune In, there are questions where, like, that would be a really good thing to ask. Yeah, I can never really... I would like to ask him about the one that we talked about to Kevin Eldon, where they're just doing all those silly Liverpool voices and stuff.
Oh,
it'd be quite interesting
Rubber Soul
to know where they're from. Yeah.
Yeah.
Been for a shit, have we, Megan? they'd probably be like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, don't remember that. Yeah.
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 What about you?
Well, I don't know. Like, I think you'd either have to go broad or ridiculously specific, I think. I mean, one thing that I think about... well, there's this thing somewhere. I think it's in A Hard Day's Right. Where there's...
A Hard Day's Right?
Yeah, the book, which What's is, like, that? Behind this... Let me just make sure I got the name right. By Steve Turner book, which is behind every Beatles song.
Okay, I don't know that.
And there's a bit in that where he talks about, you know, we all know the story behind Martha, My Dear, which is it's his sheepdog. But in that book, and I don't think it's really anywhere else, he says that Martha was actually like the name of his muse. And
oh,
so
really?
He named the sheepdog after his
right,
muse.
Right, okay.
I don't know. Like
That would make more sense.
Yeah.
Because... It's
You've always been my inspiration.
Complicated, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Complicated relationship with a dog.
Yeah. So I'd wonder, I'd like, that would be an interesting thing to ask him about, wouldn't it? Like,
yeah, that'd be brilliant. I'm having that if I see him before you.
But also, I can't seem to find much else about that anywhere.
I thought you meant find Paul.
But anyway, there we go. But I don't know. Yeah. But I'd also want to just say... Like, what's it like being Paul McCartney?
Yeah.
You know, just go route
one. Thank you.
Yeah. Probably, I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, we'll be back next week with a really great episode with the comedian Felicity Ward, which is really fun.
Yeah.
She's a brilliant comic, really, really funny, in a show called Wakefield, which is out now in Australia. If that's where you happen to be.
Sorry. Yeah, I say... This was a really good chat, and it was definitely much more one of the tangential ones.
Yeah.
But we ended up talking about cognitive behavioural therapy, didn't we, at one point?
We did. I mean, yeah, I think it ends with a cry for help.
Yeah. But that was great. She was so funny and just really, it was really cool. It was a great one.
And we do go quite off-piste with other sort of great music stuff. But it's a really fun one. Mm. I like how they're all completely different. And this is probably, you know, one of our more sort of ones where we go around the houses. But it's really great. I really enjoyed listening back to it. So thank you so much for listening. Please do rate the show if you enjoy it. And you can follow us on all the old social media, etc. And do sign up for the Patreon if you would like to. You don't have to. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.